Hi everyone, Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the UBS Market Moves podcast channel for another episode of House Call, talking equity markets with UBS Asset Management. For today's conversation, I am joined by Jeremy Zirin, Senior Portfolio Manager for the House View Equity Portfolios and serves as Head of the Private Client U.S. Equity Team. We're also joined today by Dominique Shager, UBS Asset Management's Senior Equity Investment Specialist. So with that, Jeremy, Dom, welcome to you both. Dom, I'll pass it over to you to lead today's conversation.
Thank you for having us on the show. So Jeremy, let's get started. Year to date, the S&P 500 is up 6.7%-ish. Yet more recently, we've seen stocks wobble. In fact, market volatility has picked up, and this week we saw the VIX hit a near six-month high. So, Jeremy, what's driving this recent pullback in stocks and the pickup in volatility?
Yeah, thanks, Dom. So first, I think it's important to put the recent pullback and the rise in the VIX, the market fear index, per se, in perspective. Right. Market corrections in a bull market are perfectly normal, and more times than not, they don't portend an end to the bull market in stocks unless they are followed by, you know, severe economic weakness or an economic recession. And keep in mind that the average intraday peak to trough decline in the S&P 500 going back 80 years, in years where the market's actually risen, is about 11%. So 10 to 12% on average, you get a pullback. And so this, you know, 5% pullback that we've seen over the last couple of weeks is actually fairly shallow. Now, as for the VIX, you know, its long-term average is close to 20. So the rise that we've seen in the VIX from 13 to the high teens should be put into the context of a market returning to more normal levels of volatility coming off a period of several months of exceedingly low volatility. So all that being said, you know, these market drawdowns and spikes in volatility, you know, always had some underlying driver or set of drivers. And over the last couple of weeks, I'd say that the market is absorbing a couple of pieces of new information. You know, first, you know, the Fed rate cuts appear to be getting pushed out. You know, this has caused bond yields to rise, with the two-year Treasury note hitting 5% for the first time since last October, and the benchmark 10-year Treasury bond yield reaching nearly 4.7%, you know, after starting the year under 4%. And then the second issue that the market's wrestling with is the increase in geopolitical turmoil, you know, particularly the ongoing escalation between Israel and Iran. The transmission mechanism to how this could influence the global economy, of course, is oil prices. And so far this year, you know, crude oil prices are up, you know, about 20%. We started the year at about $70 a barrel, and by last reading, crude is closer to, you know, $84, $85 a barrel. And so, at least in part, you know, the market now is placing just a higher risk of some type of disruption in the flow of oil. So in the context of, you know, equity market valuations that are somewhat high from a historical context, you know, an investor is also starting to consider the potential, you know, implications on the market of the presidential election later this year. It's not surprising that, you know, some combination of rising rates and increased geopolitical tensions have driven a near-term setback in stocks.
Thank you, Jeremy. So, you know, one of the topics that we've been talking about quite a bit in our last calls have been the stickier inflation readings that we've been hearing about. Where do you think we go from here? Is inflation now stuck at this 3 to 4% range?
Well, the short answer to your question is no, but you've hit the nail on the head, Dom. I mean, the reason that interest rates are higher has been the stickier inflation, particularly the CPI data over the last 3 months, and it's caused investors to reassess the outlook for the Fed. I think there too, we should have some, you know, perspective. It is true that, you know, the disinflationary trend that was helping to support markets much of the last year has lost some momentum, and CPI has been between, you know, 3 to 4% on a year-on-year basis, you know, really for the last 9 months or so. And I do continue to worry a little bit that, you know, the so-called last mile in inflation, or getting inflation down to the Fed's actual stated 2.0% target, may prove to be overly optimistic, or at best may take a bit longer to accomplish. However, overall on inflation, I'm fairly sanguine on the expected path of inflation going forward. I would look for softer readings in the upcoming months, and that disinflationary trend that the markets were enjoying and anticipating, I think that'll reassert itself in the second half of the year. You know, why do I say that? Well, most of the categories within the CPI that have been high aren't likely to climb higher, or they've been what I'll call statistical outliers. Auto insurance is up 22%. It's not something that is likely to continue at that pace, nor is it something that has a lot of forward predictability in terms of the overall level of prices that consumers pay. But the biggest component of CPI is a proxy for housing costs called owner's equivalent rents, often referred to as OER. And OER is a fictitious number estimating how much a homeowner would have to pay in rent for their home. And it's been driving CPI inflation higher lately, but it is known to be more backward-looking in its mechanics and more market-based real-time indicators of rent or housing costs more broadly have not been going up by nearly as much as the OEI metric. And perhaps more importantly on inflation, the Fed's preferred gauge of inflation is not the CPI, but it's an index called the PCE, or Personal Consumption Expenditures Index. And it's currently running at 2.8%, or almost a full percentage point lower than the CPI. And, you know, shelter and housing in that index has a smaller weight in its calculation. And perhaps more importantly, you know, in the Fed's last dot plot, or their projections on their policy setting, they indicated that they expected to cut rates 75 basis points, 3 rate cuts this year, with only assuming that only the PCE index would fall to 2.6%, or just 20 basis points, by year end. And so maybe some of their recent, you know, thinking has changed, and, you know, Chair Powell has indicated that rate cuts would likely get pushed out somewhat. But my conclusion overall is that, you know, the bar probably isn't that high for the Fed to cut rates later in the year, as long as PCE inflation, the Fed's preferred gauge, doesn't reaccelerate. And that seems fairly unlikely to us. You know, most of the leading indicators of inflation, you know, such as wage growth, which is a key driver of inflation from the demand side of the equation, is, you know, showing slowing. And so bottom lining it, you know, I'd expect inflation to become less sticky over time, over the course of 2024, and start to decelerate at some point in the back half of this year. And that should put, you know, rate cuts back on the table for the Fed.
Thank you, Jeremy. So essentially, you just walked us through your thoughts on the path for inflation. Let's take a step back. How are you thinking about the path for the economy? Where do we go from here?
Yeah, they're somewhat interlinked. But, you know, overall, you know, on the growth side of the equation, it's actually been quite good, right? Economic growth continues to exceed expectations. Labor market gains have been, you know, undoubtedly strong, right? Non-farm payroll gains so far this year have averaged 275,000 per month for the first 3 months of the year. And I've always said that, you know, labor markets are the key to the economy, because two-thirds of GDP is consumer spending. And when Americans have jobs and feel good about keeping their jobs, they spend. Retail sales have been healthy. And although, you know, we are seeing a bit of a large gap between the strong spending we're seeing on services like air travel and hotels and hospitality and restaurants, and we still are seeing softer readings on spending on goods. But I think that those are likely, you know, those spending patterns are likely to converge over, you know, the next few quarters. I mean, the rise in interest rates do pose a threat to the economic expansion, you know, since it impacts the more cyclical and rate sensitive parts of the economy, like housing and autos that have a big influence on broad measures of economic growth given their size. But if we're right, inflation does start to, you know, plateau and starts to slow in the second half of this year, you know, we should see interest rates come down a bit. And then, you know, frankly, you know, we've seen this movie before, right? It was just September and October of last year that the 10-year Treasury bond yield shot up to 5% on a series of higher than expected inflation data before falling to below 4% by year's end as some of those inflation, you know, readings cooled. And so a repeat of that scenario, maybe not to that extent and magnitude, but a repeat of that wouldn't surprise me. And, you know, I'd anticipate that that would be, you know, a base case for me that we see lower rates from here being supportive for our, you know, base case of an economy that is likely to show some signs of slowing, but nothing overly dramatic and not a sign, not an economy that's rolling over.
Speaking of the economy, last week marked the start of Q1 earnings season. Although it's still early in the season, what have you gleaned so far?
Yeah, at the end of the day, earnings is what drives stock prices in the long run. So, you know, looking at earnings is of vital importance. So far, I would say that, you know, the early stages of earnings season has generally been consistent with what we've seen in the last couple of quarters, which is moderately positive growth and generally supportive backdrop for stocks. You mentioned it's early. It's very early, right? Only 11% of the S&P 500's market cap has reported so far. But more encouragingly is the fact that earnings are, you know, tracking to a high single-digit year-on-year gain in aggregate, and that, you know, while companies typically beat estimates by 2 to 4% on average, the early reporters so far this earnings season are beating by 11%, so much stronger than usual. That beat rate will continue at that rate, but it does confirm that, you know, the market wobbles that we've seen over the past couple of weeks has really been driven by rising rates and geopolitical tensions, not by concerns about, you know, corporate earnings. You mentioned the banks. You know, they are always among the earliest of the reporters in earnings season, and their overall numbers look fairly encouraging as well. You know, not necessarily for the stocks in the sector, but particularly for their macroeconomic read-through. You know, we're seeing a pickup in capital market activity, like debt and equity issuance, IPOs and M&As. All of those are, you know, good signals that companies are a bit more confident in the overall macro outlook. And also, you know, as it relates to credit, credit guidance was largely unchanged by most banks. And so, you know, consumer and commercial, you know, losses in the first quarter were generally in line to a bit better than expectations. So no real signs of any deterioration in households or corporations' ability to repay loans. So overall, you know, takeaways have been more of the same, you know, moderate growth, no signs of a sudden drop off.
It certainly sounds optimistic, so good to hear. So as an active player in the equities market, how do you think investors should position given the high levels of uncertainty that we've been seeing in the market today, right? We just talked about the higher volatility, the market wobbling a bit. So how should you think about positioning?
Yeah, generally, market pullbacks create opportunities for patient long-term investors like ourselves, as long as there's not a sea change in the trajectory of the economy. We never try to time the wiggles, per se, in the markets, and stocks could very well stay choppy for some time. But valuations, which were somewhat extended, are starting to look a little bit more attractive as markets have come in a little bit. In terms of overall positioning within the equity market, we think that a balanced approach between growth and value stocks makes the most sense here. You know, growth stocks are benefiting from the build-out of infrastructure utilizing artificial intelligence, and we're likely only in the early stages of that, you know, long-term trend. But value stocks, you know, look pretty inexpensive relative to growth, and particularly some of the more cyclical areas of value, like financials, industrials, pockets of consumer discretionary. You know, those are areas that should do quite well if we do in fact have a soft landing or no landing scenario, as investors ultimately get more comfortable with the sustainability of their earnings. And then maybe one last point on positioning, you know, given the rise that we've seen in interest rates, some of the interest rate sensitive segments of the market are starting to get more attractive given their recent declines. And so areas like utilities and REITs, if we do see inflation trends soften in the second half of the year, I'd expect better performance in some of those, you know, beaten up areas as well.
So you mentioned quite a few different areas. So based on how you're thinking of how positions should generally be positioned, how does that translate to the house your equity portfolios that you and the team manage?
Yeah, as you know, down across our shelf, we have a high quality bias, which structurally drives our portfolios to have a lower risk profile than their benchmarks. But given all the cross currents in markets today, you know, we have a fairly balanced approach with what I've been calling a barbell between categories that, you know, shouldn't be overly economically sensitive, such as, you know, stable defensive holdings and core secular growth opportunities on one side of the barbell, and what I'll call cheap cyclical value on the other side. And that cheap cyclical value encompasses, you know, some of the stocks that should do well if the economy, you know, and the expansion of the economy proves to be durable. Obviously, that's a broad generalization since we manage six different portfolios, each with a different mandate. But we're not taking particularly large sector or factor tilts right now, and maybe more focused on, adding to areas that really fit into that latter bucket of cheap cyclicals, meaning that, there's opportunities in names that have lagged, where investors are skeptical on the sustainability of their earnings, where we think that there's good opportunities for the stock to outperform in an environment where the economy continues to be durable.
Perfect answer. Thank you, Jeremy. So that's a wrap from us. Thank you again for your insights. Until next month.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreement and disclosures that we provide to you about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary or ask your UBS financial advisor for a copy.